It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So good to have with us Donna Hoffman in our Cedar Falls studio, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, great to have you back.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, as well as good afternoon to Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, joining us today by phone. Hans, glad to have you in the group.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And as always, we invite our listeners to be part of our group of political junkies this hour to discuss the latest from the campaign trail. A few questions we want to throw out to you today. Is there an aspect of this campaign you think the media ought to be giving more attention to? Tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Also, another question, perhaps you're a supporter of a third-party candidate. Tell us why. 1-866-780-9100. Well, in a few minutes, Hans and Donna, we want to talk about the allegations of that special access was given to Clinton Foundation donors. Also, Donald Trump's latest reset, a new campaign manager for him, also his outreach to African Americans. But before that, let's talk a little bit about health and health innuendo being used in the last weeks of this campaign. As a matter of fact, never before in American politics have two major party nominees been as old as the present ones. Donald Trump is 70, Hillary Clinton 68. They've both declined to share the latest information about their health or to make their doctors available for interviews. Each released a brief medical statement last year in 2015. Neither has added to it since. And this, the latest chapter in the health aspect of this campaign, for weeks now, Donald Trump and his surrogates have been hinting that something might be wrong with Hillary Clinton's health. For instance, Trump remarked right here in a rally in Iowa earlier this month that Clinton was, in his words, actually not strong enough to be president. And Trump made these remarks on Clinton's health in a speech in Youngstown, Ohio, just last week.
Importantly, she also lacks the mental and physical stamina to take on ISIS and all of the many adversaries we face. Not only in terrorism, but in trade and every other challenge we must confront to turn our great country around.
Okay, these sort of health innuendo accusations about not being strong enough to be president also coming from Trump spokeswoman Katrina Pearson, alleging that Hillary Clinton has a condition brought on by a brain trauma that impairs her ability to speak. And also in an appearance in Fox News Sunday, former New York City mayor and Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani said she fails to point out several signs of illness by her. Now, what does Hillary Clinton do in reaction? Here she is in an interaction with Jimmy Kimmel on his program, Jimmy Kimmel Live, Monday night.
Here, you take my pulse while I'm talking to you.
Okay.
Alive.
Oh, my God, there's nothing there.
There's nothing there. What can I say? It's, back in October, the National Enquirer said I would be dead in 6 months.
Oh, wow. Oh, boy.
So with every breath I take, I feel like it's a...
You have a new lease on life.
Yeah, a new lease on life. I don't know why they are saying this. I think, on the one hand, it's part of the wacky strategy.
Uh-huh.
Just say all these crazy things, and maybe you can get some people to believe you. On the other hand, it just absolutely makes no sense. And I don't go around questioning Donald Trump's health. I mean, as far as I can tell, he's as healthy as a horse.
Okay. Hillary Clinton there with Jimmy Kimmel a few days ago. Donna Hoffman, let's just ask, is there any evidence to suggest that Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, for that matter, is not in good health? What do we know?
Well, you know, there's limitations to what we know here. But we shouldn't do some false equivalencies here either. So you mentioned at the top of this segment that, you know, both of them haven't really discussed this in a year. But Clinton did release a letter from her physician, 2-page letter a year ago, that mm-hmm. detailed some of the aspects, especially about the concussion that she suffered when was Secretary of State. But Donald Trump's letter came from his gastroenterologist and had the relatively ridiculous claim that said he will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. Now, on its face, that's not testable because that doctor hasn't examined all of those other presidents for their health. Now, having a doctor make a statement like Clinton did about, you know, abbreviated it may be, is also what Obama did in 2008. John McCain released something like 1,200 pages of medical records. He'd had melanoma in the 2008 campaign. You still had a physician, I went back and looked at this, you still had a physician in 2008 in the New York Times complaining that they didn't have enough information. Biden, as vice president, had released 49 pages of health information. Sarah Palin hadn't released any. Obama had released the letter, as I talked about. You still had a physician complaining that we don't know enough about their health.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a level of ridiculousness that you can get here in some ways. But I think what Hillary Clinton was referring to in that Kimmel piece is something that's instructive in that, look, I'm still here. And what voters can look at for both Trump and for Clinton is that they've both been through relatively grueling primary campaigns, and they're still standing. And yes, individually, we may want more information on both of these candidates, but there is nothing written in stone in terms of how forthcoming that they have to be.
And the funny trick here, and you alluded to it here, I think, Donna, is that while certainly the health of a candidate is key to evaluating a possible future president, there is no neutral physician evaluating these candidates. Always their own personal doctor, right?
Right. And plus, this is someone's health that we're talking about. And there is, even with presidential candidates, some element of privacy that I think reasonable people expect in terms of that doctor-patient relationship as well. And so voters need to be able to assess, especially when you have candidates that are older than the norm in some ways here, but the population is also aging, that you know, could a reasonable person look at Donald Trump and could a reasonable person look at Hillary Clinton and say, yeah, I think they're fit health-wise for the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Hans, what do you see going on here?
Yeah, and I think that this is an attempt to bring something into the debate that might stick. I think Donna is exactly right. That they're trying to bring up issues that they think that will kind of resonate with voters. I think there's a couple things that I find interesting about this. One, I'm glad that Bernie Sanders wasn't nominated, right? If we're concerned about age, right, he's older than all of them. And so maybe we should be glad that we have the candidates that we do, given the options that we had. And second, I think there's something else that I want to point out is that this is not directly related to physical health, but mental health-wise, the American Psychiatric Association actually has a rule that they've sent out to psychiatrists and psychologists, basically saying don't analyze these politicians from a distance, right? You're not capable of diagnosing someone from afar. So the only person that we should be able to trust is the doctors that these individuals are seeing. And I mean, perhaps Trump's statement is over the top, and perhaps we don't have as much information as we'd want about Clinton. But nothing in the statements that any of these doctors have given about Clinton or Trump really suggests that this is an issue. Yes, they're older, but like Donna said, the population in general is getting older, and so I'm not sure that this is so much different than a Reagan in 84 or any other candidate who is advanced in age.
Right, and Reagan did that fabulous turnabout facing Walter Mondale, wasn't it, in the debate when he said, "I will not use my." When questioned about his own advanced age, I will not use my opponent's
youth and
inexperience. There you go. You've got the quote against him.
Exactly.
One of the great lines in recent modern presidential debates. Okay. So we'll see where this goes. You think it's an attempt by Hans as well to see. Throw something at the wall, see if it sticks, even though it's unfounded.
I think that this is something that they think that can raise doubts about Clinton, given some of the concussion and other health things that have been in the news about her. And so I think that they're using this to try to maintain a stereotype that some people might have about her and her health.
Okay, let's move on to something else that's been in the news, the Clinton Foundation, the latest controversy over the Clinton Foundation, the allegation that special access was given to foundation donors when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Here's Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence making comments at a rally in Cedar Rapids on Monday.
So today, Donald Trump and I are calling for action. We're calling for action by the Democrat nominee. Hillary Clinton should shut down the Clinton Foundation right now.
Okay, Donna, tell us, what do these new emails show?
Well, there's the Clinton Foundation, there's Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and you have some back and forth between those two institutions, or at least the aides serving those institutions, talking about some of the donors and people wanting access. And there's no evidence that, hey, I've given a donation, so I must therefore be able to meet with Secretary Clinton. But that's kind of the implication here, that there's this appearance of corruption, if you will. But you know, it's certainly there for voters to look at and weigh in terms of what the Clinton Foundation does, what Hillary Clinton was doing as Secretary of State. But I would just point out that money in politics is a thing, and it's not a thing that's going to go away. And so members of Congress have people who want to see them all the time. There is this notion of donations getting you in the door. That doesn't mean that a member of Congress or Secretary Clinton or anybody else is going to then automatically do what you say just because you are a donor. But there's a longstanding notion in American politics in that money plays a role here, and interest groups, lobbyists, for example, will give money to get access to policymakers because that's what they want. That's what they need. They need the access. They need to have a hearing. And so this is in line with that aspect that we have going on at really all levels of politics. When you have people in important positions, people want to influence them. And the mechanisms that they use to try to get their foot in the door to talk to them oftentimes include donations, money, that kind of thing.
From what you can tell, Donna, and I want to ask Hans the same question, how would you classify what you're seeing in these new emails? Is it run-of-the-mill, standard practice, or is there anything illegal here? Is there anything just sloppy, careless? How would you classify it?
Well, if there was something illegal there, there would be action. I mean, these have been examined, right? The FBI has looked at these. These have been examined. There's no illegality there. But, I mean, we might use the case, a recent case, former Governor Bob McDonnell in Virginia was convicted on some bribery charges, basically. And the Supreme Court recently came in this summer and said, no, we remand it back to the lower court because and Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion on this. And he said, you know, basically routine political courtesies like arranging meetings and urging people to consider things is just part of politics. And they you know, essentially said, we got to rethink this this kind of notion. And so McDonald's lawyers in particular used an argument from the Citizens United case where the Supreme Court previously had said ingratiation and access aren't corruption. And so there's this standard that, yes, it may be unsavory, you may not like it, but that's how politics works. And, you know, there's the famous saying, there's two things you don't want to be seen being made, sausage and legislation. The same thing when we peel back, you know, kind of how politics works. It is about access. It's about networks. It's about cultivating relationships, and money greases the skids there sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Hans, before I have you jump in here, let me add here that we heard on NPR's Morning Edition this morning, the Clinton Foundation is now working to spin off or find some partners for many of its programs, including all the international activities and programs by foreign and corporate donors. This so-called unraveling would go into effect if Hillary Clinton is elected president. And then last week, the foundation announced that if she is to be elected, Bill and Hillary would step down from the foundation board, would stop accepting money from foreign and corporate sources. Does this plan solve the potential conflict of interest?
I mean, I think that what you essentially want is someone that you don't want them connected. You don't want it to have this quid pro quo donation for legislation. And I think that's the concern there, that there might be a quid pro quo exchange going on. Right, I give you something and you give me something back. And I'm not, like Donna said, that these emails have been looked at, and it's not clear that that's actually what's going on. What donors often want is exactly access. And it's not necessarily always access to push a particular policy proposal that they want passed into legislation. Often it's trying to gather information. Okay, what's going to happen in legislation going forward? They're not interested in changing that, but they want to be able to know what the legislators or the president sees coming down through the pipeline so that they can prepare for it, and so they can comply with whatever legislation might be coming forward. Mm-hmm. Second, the other interesting thing about money in politics is that we often think that we have so much money in politics and this is a major problem. In reality, I think that it's really not so much a things people are not trying to buy legislation or buy access. I think most of this money actually in reality is a consumption good, right? I donate to a candidate because it makes me feel good about supporting a particular cause, or I know this individual is going to support farmers in Iowa, and so I'm going to give money to them because I know that they're already interested in my specific positions. And so in reality, most of the money in politics is not about trying to change the outcome, but is trying to get individuals who agree with my particular politics into office. If you look at back in the early 2000s, there was a study looking at how much, what percentage of corporations donated money. It's actually a very small percent. It's like 30% or 30 or 40% of corporations even have a political action committee, and fewer than that actually give money to at the national level to candidates. And so I think we often think that there's this huge problem about donations, and these donations are buying legislation. But if that was the case, you'd see every single corporation involved in that, and in reality, you see only a very small proportion of corporations involved in campaign giving.
Donna, I wonder if you agree with that, if I can call that a little pep talk about our money and politics system, because, of course, national polls show that American people of both of all parts of the political spectrum are really see this as a major problem, the influence of money in our politics.
Yeah, it's one of those perceptions, I think, that that voters hold that, oh, my gosh, there's so much money in politics. But and there is a lot of money in politics, you know, in some ways, but politicians have to be able to run for office. And we don't want just wealthy individuals, right, to be able to run for office, which means that if you're running for office, you've got to go out and raise money. And so there is, I think, this perception on the part of the public that this money is going for nefarious purposes. And it's not. I mean, when we have those things happening, there are prosecutions. Okay, there was a sitting member of Congress recently who lost his primary, and in part of why he lost his primary is that he had been convicted of bribery charges. We prosecute that stuff. And there are a lot of regulations around money in politics. And, you know, let's be clear, with these allegations on the Clinton emails and from the Clinton Foundation, there's no allegations of bribery here. There's no allegations of kickbacks. It's just hey, we think this is kind of unsavory. And that's not illegal. Now, you may bemoan the fact that that's not illegal. But the fact is that money is power and politics is about power, and you can't separate those things out. And when we do get legislation from Congress or from state legislatures in which they're trying to channel money, they're trying to reform the system, they're trying to clean it up, transparency tends to work fairly well. But other regulations about stopping the flow of money in a certain way tends to lead to unintended consequences. And so why now do we have super PACs? We have super PACs which, you know, are sometimes dark money, unregulated, unlimited amounts. We have that because of some unintended consequences in many ways. And so the public doesn't like it, but money is an aspect of politics.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen that it didn't turn the tide for Jeb Bush, for instance, the one who threw a lot of money into the primary campaign.
Right. And just because you spend more money than your opponent doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to win. But, you know, we do know in congressional elections, for example, that incumbents tend to get more money than their challengers do. And incumbents tend to win more. But why is that money going to the incumbents? It's because they're a safe bet for reelection, and they're a current sitting policymaker, and I want to support them, or I want to get that access to the policymakers. And so, again, money's a factor. Now, we could certainly have a policy debate about with the public about public financing. So we get rid of the private aspect of this and do public financing. We've done this to some degree in presidential races, but that system is effectively dead because the presidential candidates now can go out and raise more money and not be subject to limits, which is part of the,
right.
the
and
public
in fact,
financing there.
President Obama, as a candidate, turned that money down.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one thing that I think Donna hit that I really want to emphasize is this idea that money is going to be involved in politics no matter what, right? So I think there's this idea that we can limit the amount of money involved in politics is just not possible. What we really need to be concerned about is how do we funnel that money or channel that money through paths that are transparent and open and clear. And that's a worthwhile debate. I think that we want people to know where this money is going and who's donating and basically trying to try to make transparency, right? With the increased limits on party fundraising in recent years, we've essentially that money can't go through parties anymore. The soft money can't go through parties anymore. And so what's happened instead is gone to these dark money groups, these super PACs and these 501c3s that are investing in politics. And that's the problem. I think that's the concern is that this money is going to be there no matter what. What we really need to worry about is making it as transparent as possible so that we know who has this influence and then we can call them out on it.
Okay, so in terms of campaign finance, moves towards transparency, Hans, do you see that happening in having the political will from the people who are benefiting from the current system, making it more transparent? Is there enough pressure to do that?
I mean, that's always the fear that politicians have is that they were elected under a certain system and that certain system worked for them. And so why should they want to change it? The moments when you really have seen changes in campaign finances is when there has been a public outroar or outrage about it. I think you see discussions now about increasing transparency, making this clearer about who's behind some of these advertisements and making that explicitly clear to the public. I'm not sure that you're at that point yet where people are complaining about it. You usually need some sort of major scandal, and I'm not sure that the Clinton Foundation scandal raises goes to that particular level.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to pick up with more politics from Hans Hassel of Cornell College in Mount Vernon, where he's assistant professor of politics, one of our many political analysts across the state we have invited on this show, along with Donna Hoffman, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, chewing over the latest on the political landscape. We are 75 days out from the general election. When we come back, we'll talk about the latest Donald Trump reset. He's got a new campaign manager. Also, he's reaching out to blacks and minority voters, where his poll numbers show he's not doing well, to say the least. Donna Hoffman, Hans Hassel with us. More Politics Wednesday after we take a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday with Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Donna Hoffman, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Glad to have you with us along as well with your input. 1-866-780-9100. We will get to phones in just a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit about the latest Donald Trump reset. Let's talk about his new campaign manager in just a moment. But first of all, one aspect of what we've seen in the last few days, Donald Trump reaching out to blacks, minority voters. He's evidently planning trips to urban areas with stops at churches, charter schools, small businesses in black and Latino communities. Here he is reaching out to African-American voters in a speech in Diamonddale, Michigan. Notably, though, Diamonddale, Michigan has a black population of only 1%. He said African-American communities had suffered under Democratic control and then continued with these comments.
I say it again. What do you have to lose? Look, what do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose?
Okay, Donald Trump there reaching out to the African-American community. Hans, what do you think of this? Does this make sense for Donald Trump's campaign?
I think this makes a lot of sense for Donald Trump's campaign, not because he's appealing to African-Americans, but because he's able to portray himself to whites as not racist. And I think that's a bigger concern for him. He's losing a lot of you look at the split in the Republican Party, and the Republicans that don't support him are those that have more education, are a little bit more socially conscious, aware of racial issues, may have lived abroad and a variety of different things. But this is an attempt not necessarily to win African American votes, but to give whites who may have maybe hesitant to vote for Trump because of some of the explicit racial statements that he's said in the past, a reason to vote for him. This is not about winning votes of African Americans. This is about reframing himself as not racist.
Okay, Chris is in Des Moines on this topic. Chris, welcome to the program. You wanted to comment.
Yes, thank you, Mike. One of the things, like you just said, with Trump so-called reaching out to blacks, he really isn't reaching out to blacks like the gentleman just said. He's at a white area saying that he wants the black vote, but he really doesn't. When Trump first came out, he played himself when he first came out because he's like a bigot. And so now that bigotry is coming back to bite him in the behind. You can't go to white areas and act like you want to reach out to black folks when you're not going to black folks' area to really talk to black folks. You're just talking at them. You're not talking with them. He has denied any type of communication with the NAACP, with the black radio folks. He's denied all that. He hasn't came and talked to. So it's just a front.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I said, he played himself when he first came out, and then he doesn't go into anything about what is he going to try to do. His son was on Fox TV yesterday saying that his dad is going to bring back law and order in the black community. Well, what do you mean by bringing back law and order in the black community? What do you mean by that? He hasn't explained himself on anything. It's like the old thing back in the day when the man would get with the woman and tell the woman, trust me, if we have sex, I'll stop before that happens. Just trust me. And there's no way you can trust the bigotry that he has. And the folks that support him, they support that bigotry. And
Chris, thank you very much. We have a lot of other callers. We hear you loud and clear. Thank you. Chris in Des Moines. Donna Hoffman, Donald Trump's poll numbers when it comes to minorities, when it comes to African-Americans are some of the worst in history, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty terrible at this point. And so, we can look at public opinion polls right now, and 91% of blacks are supporting Clinton, 3% are supporting Trump. Romney in 2012 won 6% of the black vote. I would like to reiterate what both the caller said and Hans said. This isn't outreach to African Americans. And if you listen to the quote that you played from Trump and then some of the other things that he has said on this particular topic recently, he's stereotyping African Americans in this country by saying you're all in poverty. Your education system that you're using is terrible. And that's just grossly overstating it. 27% of African Americans in this country live in poverty. Now, that's high, and it's the highest of any of the ethnic groups in this country. But it's not the entire group of people that he's trying to do this outreach, quote unquote, to. And it just is a big stereotype that he is talking about, and it's not nuanced in any kind of way. And as the caller mentioned, what are you going to do? It can't just be trust me. And it's not just in this area that Donald Trump has said trust me. Most of his policy prescriptions have been some variation of that. And in a general election, the public wants to start to hear a little bit more specifics. So we're starting to get Donald Trump talk a little bit more about the specifics of his immigration policy, in which he's got some changes there recently. But he's never been a candidate that's been about policy issues. He's been about more emotion.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about softening the immigration policy. Of course, if Donald Trump is known for anything, he is known for build the wall, and also his immigration policy of deporting what is estimated to be some 11 million undocumented workers in the United States. They've been these policies criticized by Republicans as well as Democrats. He postponed a planned speech on immigration that was originally scheduled for this week. But we're hearing now in the last few days, Donald Trump himself says there could be, quote, a softening in his hardline immigration proposals, not providing any detail. His campaign so far has yet to offer any sort of coordinated message on whether there will be a shift in this policy. But to Trump, to quote Trump word for word, there could certainly be a softening because we're not looking to hurt people. Hans, how are you interpreting what's been said the last few days by Trump and his campaign on the issue of immigration?
I think that they realize that they're getting beat up on it. And a campaign generally does not change their message unless they realize that the message that they have is a losing one. It was a winning message in the primaries where you've got a population of Republicans, Republican voters, who by and large have strong border security concerns and anti-immigration sentiments. But in a general election population voting electorate, that's not the same. And so what his message was a message that was a winning message in the Republican primaries, but it's a losing message in the general election. And so to borrow Mitt Romney's phrase, this is an etch-a-sketch campaign, right? He's trying to erase what he had previously stated to try to win over some new voters, and he's hoping that voters won't remember those statements, I think, in some way.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, Hans, because he is so well known for his stance on immigration, is he likely to sway anybody, or is he just as likely to perhaps lose people who really stand behind Trump for this immigration stance that he's had through the primary?
Well, I think that the people that really stand behind Trump don't have any other alternative option at this point. They're not going to jump ship to Clinton, and the third party candidates aren't particularly viable right now. He's betting that they won't have anywhere else to go but to stick with him. And so I think this is in some way very similar to his outreach to African Americans. He's not trying to fundamentally shift his position. He's trying to reach out to those individuals who would normally vote Republican, but who may be concerned about some of his racist statements and his harsh positions on immigration and human rights.
Hans Hassel with us of Cornell College, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, discussing politics. If you've just joined us on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. So let's look at perhaps what is more fundamental to the picture. We've talked about the shifts, the outreach to blacks and minority voters, the softening perhaps on immigration. Paul Manafort, campaign manager, out. Donald Trump's new campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, Steve Bannon of Breitbart News, in as the new campaign CEO. Is this what is influencing these shifts, do you think, Donna? Is this the backdrop?
Well, I think there's a combination of things here. As Hans mentioned earlier, you're changing your message only if it stops working. And it's kind of stopped working because, as he pointed out, there's the general electorate, there's the primary electorate. And particularly with Kellyanne Conway, going back to that immigration issue, earlier this week she was asked about the deportation force that Trump had been advocating, because he wants to deport all 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country, and that's 3% of the population. And most people understand that you can't logistically do that. And she talked about how that was kind of yet to be determined in terms mm-hmm. of his policy. So, again, kind of that softening of that, or the backing up a little bit on that harsh rhetoric. And so... certainly, I think that there was a recognition with some of the people around Trump that something needed to change, and they were influential in getting at least some of the personnel changed. And I think we've seen then with some of the tactics changing just subtly. But then again, Trump is still Trump. And so today, where is Trump? He's in Mississippi. He doesn't need to be in Mississippi. He's going to win Mississippi. He doesn't need to be there.
So why is he there?
Because he wants to go to rallies where people are excited about him, and they will be in Mississippi. He's also going to Florida today, which is, you know, obviously close, and Florida is really important. But, you know, earlier in the week, he went to Texas again. Texas is a red state, but in Texas, he went to Austin. Austin is like a blue bastion in Texas. And so there's an element, I think, to Trump being Trump, kind of the ego wanting to be fed by having these large rallies with lots of excited people, that boosts him, that keeps him going, even maybe on the campaign trail. And he doesn't talk about polling numbers anymore because he's not doing very well there, but he'll talk about his big and raucous rallies. Well, those are just anecdotes. That's not data. The polling is the data, and he's not doing well there. And so I think there's still a limitation on the part of the people around Trump to make him behave more like a general election candidate.
Mm-hmm. Mentioned Kellyanne Conway, the name of his new campaign manager, taking the place of Paul Manafort, who is out. Let's listen to Kellyanne Conway responding to a question by George Stephanopoulos on whether she stands by her previous criticisms. We remember she was in the Ted Cruz campaign, and at that time she criticized Trump's demeanor, his what she called insulting comments. This is, though, from an August 21st edition of ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos when he talks with her about that.
I do, and the reason is I don't like when people hurl personal insults. That will never change. That's not my style. I'm a mother of four small children. It'd be a terrible example for me to feel otherwise.
You think Mr. Trump's going to change on that?
Well, but he doesn't hurl personal insults. In other words, he, just this week, look what he talked about. He's bringing the case right to communities of color in Michigan, and he's speaking to all Americans when he does that.
Okay, so this new campaign manager, what do you make of her, Hans?
I think that she's got a tough job. You come in at this point in the campaign with 75 days left, a campaign that's struggling to get its message out, and to have that message not resonating with voters particularly well. It's a tough job that she's inherited. I think that she's trying to soften that and turn this campaign into you know, some sort of to make it not a landslide and to make it closer and possibly give Trump a chance to win. But I think she's got a really tough job.
Donald Trump to headline U.S. Senator Joni Ernst's Roast and Ride fundraiser that comes later this month in Des Moines. It's a visit that will mark Trump's fourth event in Iowa since accepting the GOP nomination last month. According to information, Donald Trump will take part in the roast portion of Senator Ernst's event. He'll share the stage with Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, also with Iowa's entire Republican congressional delegation. However, an Ernst aide confirmed Trump will not be riding a motorcycle. Okay, so I wonder, when we talk about Trump and other Republicans in Iowa, Donna, to what degree have leading Iowa Republicans tied their political fates to Donald Trump's?
Well, they have to some extent. I mean, you have Branstad advising the Trump campaign on agriculture policy, for example. You've had them appear with Trump a couple of times and say things. But, you know, Trump is doing better in the state of Iowa than he is doing in some of the other swing states. And so they're very much, I mean, they're politicians. They're very much paying attention to the context and what is going on in the state.
How do you explain that, if I may interrupt here, that so many states that were previously and are still considered swing states, but we are seeing large leads in the polls by Clinton, and yet in Iowa, it's fairly close?
Well, you know, we don't have a very large minority population in the state of Iowa, and some of the other swing states do. And that has been a factor, I think, in some of those polling numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Mel in West Des Moines. You dialed 1-866-780-9100. We're coming to the end of the hour, Mel, but please make a point if you could be brief, please.
Yeah, I'll be as brief as I can. I just wanted to know the reactions of your two people there on the 1968 Richard Nixon campaign of the Southern Strategy and how Trump may be trying to take a page from his campaign after the 64 Rights to Vote Act for the African Americans, kind of the scare of the whites to turn out in big numbers so that they could keep the black down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, remind us, if you could, Hans, of the Southern strategy that Mel's referring to. This is after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and the South, Lyndon Johnson, he admitted this: the South has lost the Democratic Party for a generation, right?
Yeah, the Southern states were strongly Democratic up until about 1964, and that's when Goldwater won five of those states after campaigning strongly against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it's at that point that you start to see a shift among among voters in the South from the Democratic Party, which had become the party of civil rights, to the Republican Party. I think that Trump's nomination, some have said, is the culmination of that strategy. It may not have, conservative ideology may not have been explicitly racial when it, in the view of many party elites, but I think that it, among most of the mass public, the general public, Republican voters, race has always been a strong issue. It's always been something simmering below the surface, and the ideological rhetoric that conservative Republicans have been using has tapped that. And Trump's rhetoric, it only just brings that to the surface in a way that perhaps was not quite as visible before. And so I think that Trump is different in that he's being explicit on race, where others were a little bit more implicit. Goldwater campaigned against the Civil Rights Act not on racial grounds, but on principled grounds. The idea that the government should stay out of local affairs, national government should stay out of local affairs, and he viewed that as a local decision. It was not an explicitly racial issue for Goldwater. It is an explicitly racial issue for Trump, and he's tapped that that sentiment and brought it to the forefront where it was not previously. It was in the kind of the rhetorical, the rhetoric was much more high-minded.
I wonder if in the last 5 minutes, Hans and Donna, we can get you to step back from the picture, view, I guess, how the polls are shaping up, what trends perhaps you're seeing. Donna, let me ask you, first of all, which states are shaping up as most important in this election?
Well, I mean, we have the traditional swing states, of which Iowa is one, Ohio is important, Pennsylvania is important, Florida is important. But the Electoral College map is actually being shaken up in some pretty interesting ways. So, for example, a couple of recent polls out of Georgia show it essentially tied there. And that's really interesting. You have North Carolina being interesting because you have some unpopular Republicans in the state as well, and the changing demographics of North Carolina. Also, and so while we have some of the traditional swing states, you have some interesting states that may move. Colorado seems to have moved into the Clinton camp. It's been more swingy, if you will, in that sense. So the map is at some levels, there's some continuity there, but then there's some interesting dynamics. But I think one of the bigger issues, at least for me, in terms of some of the things that I watch, is how that affects what we would think of as the down ticket races. And so there's a new projection out today that there's now a 60% chance that Democrats will take control of the Senate. 2 months ago, we weren't talking about the House being in play really at all. And it's still probably not, but there is still at least a chance that the Democrats could actually flip the House. I think it's still very remote, but there are a lot of changing dynamics in this particular race. And so we're in particular watching what happens at state levels, and then where you have some states where you're getting voters willing to split tickets, which, historically voters have moved away from that in some of the recent cycles. But you have in Indiana, for example, Evan Bayh in the Senate race up ahead, but Trump's still doing decently well in the state.
Mm-hmm. We have a little less than a minute, Hans, if you could close out with your sort of bigger thoughts on the implications, repercussions possible from this election in 75 days.
Yeah, I think that Donna talking about split ticket voting, that's one of the most interesting things that I see. That split ticket voting has not happened on a large scale since the late 80s, early 90s. And now for Republicans, they're essentially hoping that that will return, that you'll get people that will vote Democratic on the presidential level, but will vote Republican at the congressional level. There are definitely some things that have completely opened up. Donna didn't mention Utah, and I think that that's interesting. This is a state that Romney won by 45%. Clinton has just opened a campaign office in Salt Lake City, and they're only down 7 or 8 points there in recent polls. And so I think that that's interesting, just about how it changes the map.
Okay, we have to go. Thanks so much, Hans Hassel of Cornell College, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can join me for another edition tomorrow, Pints and Politics, a live event tomorrow at 5:30 at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Be part of the live audience. I'll talk with Gazette columnists James Lynch, Linda Waddington, and Todd Dorman. That's tomorrow. Just show up, CSPS, 5:30 on Thursday evening. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Yes.